Okay, so I'm just gonna start with a case, sorry, with a paper that I thought was very interesting and was published by the group of Vanderbilt University. And one of the main authors is Dr. Joyce Johnson. And as you can see the title, it's about post-deployment respiratory syndrome in soldiers that came back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So they started this study because there was a group of soldiers that developed unexplained symptoms after they were deployed to Southwest Asia. So I think there are a couple of studies that are important for this study that were done actually by the same group in conjunction with the US Army. And they actually found in one of the studies, they showed that out of 380 patients, most of them had definable entities, but a large percentage of them, like 30% of them, had unexplained symptoms. In a subsequent study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, they found that 77% of these patients had constrictive bronchiolitis. But it is really interesting that these pathological symptoms were like, these pathological findings were not necessarily correlated well with PFT's abnormalities. So in this study, they actually wanted to define better the pathology, and they did a very, very detailed histopathological study in 50 patients that had these symptoms, the unexplained symptoms, and they compared this with non-smoking controls. I have to say that the controls are, when I read the study and I saw the pictures, you know, the controls are completely normal patients that in which there was, you know, they had like a brain death and there were lungs that were rejected for the transplant. So they did a pathology evaluation, and they also did morphometrics. And they had a lot of data, clinical data, PFTs, and CT scan data. The criteria for inclusion basically is that they had to have, you know, available blood from these patients. And in all patients, there was constrictive bronchiolitis in the biopsy. I think it's this study represents probably the worst phenotype of these unexplained syndromes, syndrome that I define. And also they excluded any other entities like granulomatous diseases, interstitial lung diseases, or COPD. So in the histopathology evaluation, they had they took four serial sections from the blocks and stained them with H&E, PAS, VVG, and precrocerous red. And they also did other IHCs to, you know, characterize the immune cells like CD4 and CD8. And they also did IHC to elastin. And they evaluated very multiple variables by histology, like the epithelial height, the lamina propria thickness, the smooth muscle thickness, the adventitia thickness, and the collagen and elastin content. And also they describe well the immune inflammatory cell infiltrate. For morphometrics, they define very well the findings in the distal pulmonary arteries. They actually measure the median adventitia thickness and the wall to the lumen ratio on BVG. And also in the alveoli, they define the presence of the blood capillary density, the collagen content, and elastin content. And the main results, you know, these patients were very young. Most of them were men and non-smokers. And I think the most important clinical finding is that all the patients had reported exposure to an environmental hazard. And almost half of them had exposure to a sulfur mine fire in Iraq. There were other exposures. And I think very interesting, like the initial PFTs in all these patients, in most of these patients, 60% of them were normal. The rest of them had some reduction in DLCO, but this was not really, really bad DLCO reduction, I have to say, because I remember looking at the graph. And few of them had mild restriction and obstruction. And all of them had persistent symptoms on follow-up. I have to say that all of them also had a reduction in the TLC and follow-up. So, and by histology, found that all of them had a fibrous remodel of the bronchial walls that was consistent with constrictive bronchiolitis. And well, this was actually the inclusion criteria. And few of them had respiratory bronchiolitis. But I think the morphometrics is what's really interesting. So in the bronchioles, there was a significant increase in the thickness of the lamina propria and the hypertrophy of the smooth muscle. And also a significant increase in the collagen in the subepithelium. This is not very surprising because the controls are completely normal, I have to say. So they don't have disease controls. But still, you know, it was very significant, of course. And a threefold increase in the number of CD4 and CD8 cells in the airway wall as well. And the distal in the distal pulmonary arteries, they have an increase in the medial thickness due to smooth muscle hyperplasia. Hypertrophy and an increase in the ventricular thickness. I will show you the pictures of that put in the paper as well. And in the trabecular septa, they had a decrease in the capillary density and an increase in the collagen and elastin. The pleura also was abnormal. They had they reported pleural thickening and mononuclear inflammatory cells and increased collagen. So I think one part that is really important in the paper is that they actually did unsupervised hierarchical clustering to define endotype of disease. And they actually show that this group of patients, actually, it's a very well-defined cluster compared to the normal controls. And in all the patient, all these patients, you know, they had subclusters, and in all the subclusters, the decrease in DLCO and the air trapping on CT scan and the report of exposures were equally represented. So it seems that, you know, it seems that they have a lot of clinical characteristics that will make this probably a syndrome. I think it's something that they say is that they didn't find any specific correlations between and a specific clinical feature with pathological abnormalities. So it's more homogeneous, all the findings that they found, but there's not a single one that is more important, I will say. And I say also that the most discriminatory findings were an increase in C4 and C8 cells in the small airways, an increase in the medial thickness in the distal pulmonary arteries, and the reduced density of capillaries in the alveolar septa and the presence of pleural pathology. So I think the discussion is very interesting because they actually want to propose that this is a new syndrome. They want to propose that this has the post-deployment respiratory syndrome in which the patient should have a history of deployment to this part of the world, inhalation exposures, the presence of respiratory symptoms, and a lung pathology that affects all distal lung compartments, which is in contrast to the classic constrictive bronchiolitis, because those, in this case, the patient had more mild syndrome symptoms, and they are not necessarily initially seen as having air trapping on chest CT or abnormality of PFDs. I think I want actually Dr. Tassler to, if you can comment, because I think they actually cite a paper in which you are a co-author, in which they, it's a paper of Iranian survivors of exposure to sulfur mustard gas. And I think the findings in some way are similar. So I find interesting that they want to define a syndrome, but I think there's probably a pathological spectrum of, you know, constrictive bronchiolitis that can occur after some exposure. And we don't know exactly because their cohort is very homogeneous, but they actually don't include disease controls. And also, you know, the controls are completely normal. So how do we know this doesn't happen with our exposures? So, or similar, you know, gas toxic exposures, you know, so yeah, I don't know if there's, and I think I'm, that's all what I think wanted to show, talk about the paper. I can show the pictures because I think it's, can you see my screen now or? Or you're still, but are you still seeing the Word document or?
Yes, the Word
Okay.
document.
Let me just,
Julian, I just want to make sure, did they only include the original soldiers that had constrictive bronchiolitis? Is that all they looked at?
So the only,
Okay.
and they don't include the ones that didn't have any sinus constrictive bronchiolitis. So I think this is a worse phenotype that they, you can see probably in this syndrome, you know. Let me just, okay, so here, you know, I mean, as you can see here, you know, this is like a ex example of a picture that I put, you know, like the a soldier with, you know, well-defined findings, able to pathological finding, like if you see normal controls are just completely normal patients. And, you know, they have here the BVGs, you know, and the picro-red series as well. But I think, I mean, this is what I show the hierarchical clustering, and the patients are clustering very well compared to the controls. Okay, so I think I will probably continue with the other manuscript.
Any questions or comments before we move on?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You know, the morphometry sounds a little interesting because when you do morphometry, you have to have very carefully inflated specimens. And it sounds to me like these are not, these are all handled differently. Obviously, the controls would be fairly well controlled, but the specimens, I guess I'd want to look into the morphometric details there because I'm sure they weren't inflated. I'm sure they were not all handled in a similar fashion.
Yeah, they probably don't all look as beautiful as that, the image that they showed in the manuscript, which looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I have to say that I think are all clinical cases. So it's they're probably not inflated in the same way, you know, and the controls probably are different because the controls are, you know, long front explants, I'm sure, like not necessarily from the same, maybe not from the same center. Actually, they don't define that well.
Julian, thanks. This is Tazelar. The cases that we looked at had very subtle findings as well. There were no classic, you know, post-transplant sort of completely obliterated airways, but they had all the findings that you show, you know, including smooth muscle hyperplasia, an increase in connective tissue between the basement membrane and the smooth muscle. So, you know, I think it's real, but it is fairly subtle, and it's you know, the cases that you have to go back and look at twice sometimes. You look at them and you don't really see the abnormality first time around. But when you begin to look at the small airways, we didn't do vessels and you know, we didn't do morphometrics, but the findings I think were fairly similar.
Nice, nice. That's good. Well, it's part of the same syndrome then.
So can I ask, one of their proposals is that we apply the label constrictive bronchiolitis to these findings, but as to your point, Henry, it never seems to rise to that same threshold. So it's, I don't know, it seems like we're conflating two different circumstances.
I think that depends on whether you define constrictive bronchiolitis as only severe or whether it can be mild. I would call this
Well,
mild.
yeah, but there's no evidence that it progresses to the lesion that historically we've recognized based on the characteristics that Henry referred to. So, I mean, we don't know that they're related. There's an assumption that this will travel that path, but no evidence that that's true.
Why should constrictive bronchiolitis be progressive?
Well, historically, it is. I mean, that's the only way we've recognized it.
If you look at the paper by Kraft in 1996, there were four cases exactly like this that weren't particularly progressive, and the term constrictive bronchiolitis was used. I mean, if you want to define it as a relentlessly
Well,
progressive
but they
thing,
had
then these don't
measurable
fit.
airflow limitation, and from a histologic point of view, the changes were more advanced than the ones they're illustrating here, right? Is that not true?
I'm talking about Monica Kraft's paper. No, that's not true. They were identical to this.
I mean, the ones that we looked at in Iran were actually identified because they had, quote, resistant asthma. So I think in at least in that group, I don't know about this group in particular, but at least in that group, they were in a persistent asthma clinic and they didn't have, you know, they didn't have reversible airway, you know, obstruction and they ended up getting lung biopsies. and they actually had a fairly, it was a little different scenario in that they were on the front where Hussein was using sulfur mustard gas. So they all had a very, you know, one or two exposures that was fairly well-defined, unlike, you know, the burn pits and stuff here, which are, people could have variable amounts of exposure probably and be in the vicinity.
So I guess the question is, can we actually diagnose something as constrictive bronchiolitis without evidence of obstruction, of small airway obstruction?
Yeah, you know, we see
cases. It all depends on how you define it. You can define.
That's what I'm asking. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I have to say that in this case, most of them didn't have abnormalities in PFTs, but over time, it seems that all of them developed decrease in the TLC. But you know, the follow up, it's kind of, it's somewhat, interesting, because some patients who had a follow-up 15 years and other patients had a follow-up of 1 year. So, I mean, there may be some progression clinically, but we don't know, because this study is probably very small.
Yeah, and I guess my only point is, if we start applying the term constrictive bronchiolitis to the histology illustrated in this paper, I think we will cause more harm than not. Because you can probably find airways that look like these in a lot of lung biopsies. And if we attach the label constrictive bronchiolitis, which means something biologically different, I think, to many pulmonologists, I just think we're going to overdiagnose a condition that will become less meaningful. That's all.
But perhaps we can call it how they call it, post-deployment respiratory syndrome. and it will be more like, you know, in between.
Okay, ready to move on to your next one?
Yeah, the next one. So the next one, it's a paper about cryobiopsy. And it's about the identification of, you know, adenocarcinoma subtypes in cryobiopsy. And I know this is a bit controversial still, but I think it's interesting to discuss it, you know. So I think they want to know if a cryobiopsy is good to determine micropapillary and solid subtypes. And as you know, there are papers, you know, different papers from, you know, Memorial Sloan Kettering Group and also from Japan showing that the presence of these subtypes may be related to high risk of occult lymph node metastasis and also high risk of local recurrence and decreased free survival and decreased overall survival. And also an increased risk of post-operative lymph node upstaging. So, based on these papers, you know, these patterns are classified as high grade. And recently that paper from Dr. Moreira and the ISLC group, you know, in JTL proposed this new grading system in which the presence of 20% of more of these high grade subtypes, it's called poorly inferentiated, and it's associated with decreasing disease-free survival and this decreased overall survival in stage one lung adenocarcinoma. So Dr. Yatavi and their group in this paper actually based their discussion a little bit on this paper and say that, you know, the pre-op identification of these components may influence surgical strategies, including the additional lymph node evaluation or the extent of lymph node dissection or indication for a limited resection. So they have, they say also, you know, that there are a couple of studies from Japan as well showing that conventional biopsies are insufficient for identifying high grades because they are very low, the sensitivity is really low, between 7% and 15%. But they say, you know, cryobiopsies can collect glial samples and will have fewer artifacts, right? Crush artifacts. So they had this small study, single center retrospective, with 115 patients that had a clinical 1A lung adenocarcinoma. And in all these patients, they had transbronchial biopsy brushings or forceps biopsies or fine needle aspiration that were done before the cryobiopsy. So they had the pathological review was performed by two pathologists that were blinded to clinical data and outcomes. And the results were achieve a consensus. And they had a threshold of 5% to identify microfibrillary or solid components. And they, after performing the pathology review, they evaluated the concordance rate of the cryobiopsy diagnosis with the surgical specimens. They also, you know, inquire about clinical factors that predict high-grade subtypes and also clinical pathological parameters that can affect the ability of cryobiopsy to diagnose high-grade adenocarcinomas. And they classify their cases based on the percentage of microfibrillary and solid components. So, you know, the median tumor size was 23 millimeters. And the consolidation, the median consolidation was 15.6. So most cases clinical were diagnosed by stage 1A2. And the predominant histological subtype was papillary and then acinar adenocarcinomas. There was no severe, no cases of life-threatening bleeding, and severe bleeding was just seen in like less than 2% of the patients. And I made this table with, you know, the data they showed, and basically they, you know, evaluated performance of the cryobiopsy with sensitivity and specificity. And based on the, if the patterns were the primary predominant pattern, secondary predominant, either primary or secondary, or just the presence of the pattern. And you know, the specificity seems, looks a bit high for most of them, but I have to say that for micropapillary, the specificity wasn't perfect. And especially, you know, when you have a secondary predominant pattern. There were no cases of primary in which micropapillary was a predominant pattern. But the sensitivity can be tricky for solid patterns. And I have to say, well, just by the evaluating the presence of the pattern, the sensitivity can be low. But if the patterns are, you know, so the solid pattern is like the main pattern, you know, the primary pattern, the sensitivity can be relatively high. But actually they found that when solid was the secondary predominant pattern, they didn't identify a single case. So they say, you know, that they wanted to see, you know, which factors influence this concordance. And for micropapillary, they didn't find any associations. But for solid tumors, they found that tumors that had a higher, relatively big size and that increased percentage of the solid component were more likely to be concordant. But they also said, you know, like clinical factors predicting the presence of these patterns, you know, if the patients were heavy smokers or had a larger consolidation size. So in their discussion, they talk that, you know, that the sensitivity is still much better than for forced biopsies, which for those cases is less than 20%, right? For those, for that technique. And they say that advantage of using a cryobiopsy is that you can have tumor from the lateral side of the tumor, of the mass. And also the specimen is 3 to 7 times bigger, which and has less crush artifact. They also conclude that, you know, that sampling errors may affect the solid component, but interpretation patterns, interpretation may be still a problem for micropapillary, and that's why the specificity is not 100%. And they talk about a lot about that paper from the ISLC, and they said, you know, that definitely these patterns, the prevalence is relatively high in many series. So it's not negligible to think about them. And many, in some centers, you know, this may lead to surgical management. So they say that using cryobiopsy may be much better than a forceps biopsy, even though the sensitivity may be low for some for solid component. So I think the something that I have a critical review is they mention this paper a lot, but they don't use their proposed grading system. So we don't know the relevance still of this, right? Because there's no randomized data showing that this staging system is really helpful and useful for clinically. But you know, it may be based on their data that they show. So I think some risk, you know, this is a single center retrospective study, and actually the number of cases are very small. I will say that there are very few cases of solid pattern. So I think that's all that I wanted to talk about that paper.
Any questions or comments? I think it's, I don't know. I think it's a stretch to say that the difference between a good, you know, transbronch and a cryobiopsy and detection of these features is going to be useful preoperatively. I mean, I don't think at our institution, anything is going to change preoperatively because stage is really all that they're concerned with for these patients, but interested to hear others' thoughts.
It could be that this is getting to high stage disease where you don't have the lobectomy.
And
but for that, they do EBIS and, you know, do staging. I kind of agree with Jen. I'm not sure. This seems like an answer to a problem most of us don't have anyway.
Yeah, sorry, Tom, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say I would agree with that, but perhaps they're saying that in patients that you're not going to get the lobe on, the bigger the piece, the more likely you are to see something. I think that's all they're saying, I think.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask, Julian, they selected their patients for low stage disease, right?
Yeah, all of them were stage 1.
And did they show that upgrading these tumors had any effect on the predicted stage? I mean, that would be the only way to show this might have value. They didn't show that, right?
They didn't show that, yeah.
So their hypothesis is it might matter, but they didn't show that it mattered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes.
Okay.
I might have missed it, but what about the role of core biopsies? Our surgeons go for core biopsies a lot more now, and we get quite big samples. You know, CT-guided core biopsies.
Yeah, well, I mean, they say that biopsies in general, all in a cryobiopsy, have low sensitivity for detection of these patterns. But
I think that they might just be going with, you know, the crushed type kind of biopsies you get with forceps. But those core biopsies are really nice. They're usually not crushed. They're big. They didn't discuss that at all.
No, they didn't. They didn't, though. No.
Do you all report when you see solid or micropapillary in your current biopsies? Or do you just say poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma?
I mentioned it in a comment. But I also think, again, the implication is that this would potentially change management somehow. And I don't see if you had a, you know, lower, like less concerning patterns that they would not do surgery or not do a lymph node dissection. So again, kind of like Henry said, it seems like an answer to a problem we don't have.
Yeah.
Only thing that I could see maybe would be a segmental resection versus a lobectomy because of the association between micropapillary and solid and stas, but that's, I don't know if they think that far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That would be stretching it.
Yeah.
Unlikely.
All righty. Any other comments before we move on to another cryobiopsy paper? A different take on it.
Okay, I'm just kind of stop me.
Yeah.
Sharing. Okay.
Thank you, Julian. Those are two great presentations.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Does that look okay for you all? Okay, so I'm going to talk about this paper, another cryobiopsy paper, as I alluded to, but this one is looking at cryobiopsy for the diagnosis of mediastinal lesions, and they did a randomized trial comparing it to EBUS. So I think, you know, all of us can appreciate how much EBUS has improved lung cancer staging, obviating the need for mediastinoscopy and other more invasive procedures. And it really is very successful in staging of lung cancer. There are some limitations, however, to EBUS, particularly in the diagnosis of non-lung cancer type diagnoses in mediastinal lymph nodes. And sometimes the tissue is often sufficient for advanced molecular testing, but not always. And that was kind of their main impetus for this study, where they looked, I think most of us are familiar with the kind of the mechanism of cryobiopsy. So I'm not going to go into that in any great detail. But what they did here is that, let me come down to there. Yeah, there we go. So what they did here is they looked at 197 patients. With mediastinal lesions that were over 1 centimeter in short axis on CT. And they compared eBus-FNA, 4 passes of eBus-FNA versus 3 specimens collected using cryobiopsy. And they did those 2 procedures sequentially on each of these patients, and they did them in random order. So in half the patients, they did cryobiopsy first and then eBus. And in the other half of the patients, they did it in the reverse order. So they obtained their cryobiopsies by making a small incision in the airway wall and then putting the cryoprobe through the airway wall into the mediastinal lesion. So they did exclude any patients that had cysts or abscesses. And they also excluded any patient who needed an endobronchial or a transbronchial biopsy at the same time. So these were just patients who were just having essentially mediastinal evaluation. And so the ROSE was not performed. So they didn't have any rapid on-site evaluation, and the pathologists were blinded to which procedure was done first. And then they defined a diagnostic biopsy as what they considered a definitive pathological explanation for whatever the targeted lesion was. So if it was just suspicious, that actually didn't count as diagnostic. But if they found granulomas or other things that they thought were probably consistent with sarcoid, they did consider that a diagnostic biopsy. So here is kind of their baseline characteristics. The average lesion size was just over 2 centimeters, as you can see there, and their most commonly sampled nodal stations were 4R and 7. So in total here, when we look at the diagnostic yield for these procedures, 181 patients out of the 197 that they looked at did have a diagnostic biopsy from one or both procedures. So their overall diagnostic yield was 93%. About 78% of patients had the same diagnosis, essentially. So both procedures were diagnostic and there was the same diagnosis by both cryobiopsy and TBNA. So that was, almost 80% of the time, the diagnosis was the same. So in 26 cases, the cryobiopsy was diagnostic when the EBUS was not. So those diagnoses included 8 cases of tuberculosis, 6 cases of non-small cell lung cancer, 6 cases of lymphoma, and they were able to subtype all of those types of lymphoma based on the cryobiopsy sample, 5 cases of sarcoidosis, and 1 seminoma. They also had 4 lung cancer cases where they said the cryobiopsy provided more information about the tumor. So they were able to identify things like sarcomatoid features. They were able to identify 1 case of combined small cell when only 1 component was recognized on EBUS, and 1 had concurrent infection, actually had TB as well. And then conversely, there were 3 cases where only the TBNA was diagnostic and the cryobiopsy was not, and all 3 of those were non-small cell lung cancers. So overall, the diagnostic yield for cryobiopsy was higher, so it was 92% roughly versus 80% for EBUS. But almost all of the difference seemed to be made up between these kind of categories, the uncommon tumors and the benign disorders. So the diagnostic yield was quite a bit higher for cryobiopsy for the uncommon tumors. It was 92% versus only 25% for EBUS. And for benign diseases, it was 81% for cryobiopsy and 53% for TBNA. So, but the diagnostic yield for lung cancer actually was the same, essentially. So 94 versus 96%. So this seemed to be most helpful when there was either an uncommon tumor or a benign disorder that was the diagnosis. So as far as yield for molecular testing, let me see, I don't think I have a table for this one. So the yield for molecular studies was also a bit higher for cryobiopsy. So it was 93% versus 74% for TBNA. And there was no difference in these groups, whether the TBNA was done first or the cryobiopsy was done first. And the yield of cryobiopsy also did not seem to depend on the lesional size or the station of the abnormality, this lymph node station of the abnormality. They had a few complications, not many. I think they had 3. So 2 pneumothorax and 1 mediastinum. And the cryobiopsy procedure took about 2 minutes longer than the TBNA procedure. And the cryobiopsy samples averaged nearly 11 millimeters squared, which is pretty huge, pretty big piece of tissue. So in their discussion, they talk about prior studies that they have done and that others have done that actually use forceps for mediastinal biopsies if they're suspecting an unusual tumor or a benign diagnosis. So using like a transbronchial forceps to go across the airway into the mediastinum instead. And this is kind of taking it to the next level, if you will, and using a cryoprobe instead of forceps. So the forceps biopsies that have been described in the literature did increase yield for diagnosis of lymphoma and sarcoidosis in particular. And now they're saying that the cryobiopsy is also, you know, well tolerated and feasible for these lesions and produces three times more tissue than the forceps biopsies based on prior studies. There were three cases where the tBNA was diagnostic and the cryobiopsy was not. So I think, you know, it would be important to target patients for this type of procedure. And probably if suspicion that it's just a regular non-small cell lung cancer is high, then it's probably not needed. But it can be done for mediastinal lesions and does increase diagnostic yield if there's an unusual diagnosis at play and may also yield more for molecular studies as well. So that's that one in a nutshell. Any comments?
Did they use an ultrasound to guide that?
The cryobiopsy, I believe they did.
They use CT for the regular cryos.
So I think this was all ultrasound guided.
Hey, thank you, Jen. I was wondering, in these three cases where the tBNA was diagnostic while the cryobiopsy was not, did they do the tBNA first and then maybe they had some problems with the cryobiopsy? I don't know.
Yeah,
there
I don't.
Some issues.
Yeah, I don't know that they gave the that level of detail for those three cases, but I'll definitely look back at that, Anya, and let you know if I can tease that out.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions or comments? Kind of an interesting study. Alrighty, and then
I don't think I have ever seen a cryobiopsy for a thymoma or any of these mediastinal lesions.
Yeah,
I don't know if you even do that.
Yeah, and they were really, you know, these were more nodal, you know, based disease. So I think there may have been one thymic carcinoma, but otherwise, I don't think there were any thymic neoplasms in this group. And I'm wondering if it's just an accessibility issue, you know, if it's more anterior mediastinal, I'm not sure, but these were more nodal based, you know, issues.
Yeah. So
Jen, sense. They make an incision in the airway for the cryoprobe. Do they sew it up or just let it heal or what?
I don't know. I don't know what they did.
I'm not sure I'd opt for one of these.
Yeah. All right, and then I'll go through this last one quickly. So this is a multi-institutional study on mesothelioma, basically comparing features seen in biopsy with larger resections, specifically looking at nuclear grade necrosis and histologic subtype. So by histologic subtype, they mean epithelioid, biphasic, or sarcomatoid. So this was a large 19-center multi-institutional study. So, you know, while we all are very familiar with dividing mesothelioma into epithelioid, biphasic, and sarcomatoid categories, you know, these additional features are coming into play with the new release of the WHO. And it is recommended currently that you try to give your best estimate of these additional criteria, including, you know, necrosis, nuclear grade, based on biopsy specimens to help guide patient management, since many patients never get any kind of a resection. But how this really correlates with what we see in resection specimens is not very well defined. So that was the impetus for this study. So as I mentioned, this is 19 institutions, and they looked at 429 patients with pleural malignant mesothelioma, and they had paired biopsy and resection specimens, and it's a wide range of time, so it covered from 1995 to 2018. So the resections included things like pleural peels, pleurectomies, and autopsy specimens as well. So the pathology review was performed by expert authors, pulmonary and thoracic pathologists at each institution without centralized review. And the histologic features of the resection were considered the gold standard for evaluation. So as you might expect, they had a pretty marked male predominance in their mesothelioma cohort. 83% were men with an average age of 66 years. And 46% of patients received neoadjuvant therapy before their resection specimen was procured. So the biopsies, as far as those go, most of them, 3/4 of the biopsies were obtained by VATS. 15% were core and 9% were open biopsies, NOS. So when you looked at the histologic subtype between the biopsy and the resection, they were concordant in 80% of cases. And as you might expect, the number of epithelioid mesotheliomas was overestimated by biopsy compared to resection. So basically, you know, if you have more material to look at, you're more likely to find a sarcomatoid component and to call it biphasic. So the number of epithelioid went down from 78.6 to 63.2 when considering the biopsy compared to the resection. And the biphasic cases were underestimated and saw a corresponding increase at resection from 18% to 33%. The sarcomatoid cases that were called sarcomatoid on biopsy actually stayed pretty consistent and was a pretty good indicator that the lesion was going to be sarcomatoid at the time of resection. So when they kind of looked at it a different way here, they looked at sensitivity and specificity of these features on biopsy. So if you want to think about it that way, a biopsy diagnosis of epithelioid mesothelioma was not a very specific indicator of a resection diagnosis of pure epithelioid meso. The specificity was 55%, and biopsy was not particularly sensitive for biphasic morphology with a sensitivity, again, of about 50%. The thing that it seemed like they struggled the most with, the biggest difference between biopsy and resection, was the ability to estimate the percent of epithelioid and sarcomatoid components, which were often asked to do on biopsy. That had only fair agreement between biopsy and resection with a cap of 0.27. Most cases that were called epithelioid at biopsy, 96% of those cases had at least 50% epithelioid at morphology at resection. So they were still mostly epithelioid, but again, they were picking up a more minor sarcomatoid component, and they qualified as biphasic. So overall, that agreement between biopsy and resection for classification was a moderate agreement with a cap of 0.54. When they looked at nuclear grading, again, probably not surprising that we saw a bit of an increase in nuclear grading at resection compared to biopsy when more tissue was procured. So the agreement in nuclear grade between biopsy and resection was present in 75% of the case. There was no changes. So that's moderate agreement again with a cap of 0.6. 54 cases had a change in the nuclear grade at resection, and 93% of those were upgraded one level. So most commonly went from a grade 1 to a grade 2 at the time of resection. Necrosis was concordant in 80% of the cases. So that was, again, moderate agreement. So necrosis on biopsy was very specific for necrosis at resection. So if they saw it, it was typically there at resection, but again, not very sensitive on a small sample. So they were just picking up more areas of necrosis at the time of resection. And they also noted that low nuclear grade seemed to be more common at resection in cases that had neoadjuvant therapy. So 42% of those patients had grade 1 nuclei compared to 20%, but the necrosis was not different in patients who got neoadjuvant therapy versus those that didn't. And they just show this picture to kind of illustrate their two most common changes from biopsy to resection, which was to go from a pure epithelioid tumor as depicted in A to a biphasic tumor as depicted in B, and to upgrade the nuclei from grade 1 depicted in figure C here, and then upgrading it to grade 2, which is present in D. So in summary, about 20% of cases of malignant mesothelioma classified as epithelioid on biopsy will be reclassified as biphasic if the whole or if a larger resection specimen is reviewed. And there is also a tendency to upgrade a nuclear grade. About a third of cases were upgraded from grade one to grade two at the time of resection. And I think that's it in a nutshell. Any comments, thoughts about this one?
Did they make a difference between the specimens that had received neoadjuvant therapy, meaning were there more changes between what was said on biopsy versus resected between the treated versus non-treated?
Only for nuclear grade. So the treated were more likely to be grade one compared to the untreated tumors, which is kind of an interesting finding. But other than that, they didn't observe any differences. Any other comments or questions?
For the, this is Joanne. How did they tell the treatment effect versus, you know, the kind of a true discrepancy between the the biopsy and the resection? You know, for example, necrosis or fibrosis or the kind of thing, you know, so in the breast or soft tissue tumors.
Yeah, they didn't go into that. Yeah, they didn't go into that too much. They did look at necrosis between treated and untreated tumors and didn't see any difference between the treated and untreated tumors, but didn't go into detail regarding cellularity or fibrosis or other evidence of treatment effect. They did have one patient that I saw included in one of the tables that had no evidence of disease at resection, and I presume that was a treated patient. But other than that, they didn't go into it much.
Either that or a misdiagnosis.
Yeah, one or the other. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we really know very well what is treatment effect in mesotheliomas.
Yeah.
I mean, specifically with necrosis, we see it with or without treatment, and same with fibrotic areas. I think it's really difficult.
All right. Well, all the other articles from this month are summarized in your document, if you care to peruse those. And it was lovely to talk to everyone this morning, and I hope you all have a great day.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Thank you.
It was great.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.